first up, and I don't know which of you wants to take this, but for people who, I mean, there are people who have not heard of General Butt Naked. So who's this guy we're talking about?
Why don't you go ahead, Danielle?
Okay, General Butt Naked was the name of a Liberian warlord who in the mid-1990s fought naked. He fought in the nude because it was based on a traditional belief that if you were nude during warfare, it would protect you from bullets. So General Butt Naked was popularly known and feared throughout Liberia. And the name General Butt Naked sort of fueled a lot of press interest and kind of, you know, there were a lot of snickers about this name, but he was actually a really feared warlord who was extremely brutal and who was responsible for the deaths of thousands of people during Liberia's civil war.
How did you first hear about him?
You know, Danielle and I, we began production on the film in 2005, but I'd first heard of General Butt Naked probably around 2003 in a small section of a book called The World's Most Dangerous Places by Robert Young Pelton. And it was just a very small blurb, you know, basically saying, you know, once a warlord, now a preacher preaching peace and reconciliation on the streets of Monrovia, Liberia's capital. And it was really just one of those, you know, little story blurbs that just kind of gut punches you, just kind of makes you stop in your tracks and go, my God, you know, I'd never heard of this before. This is a kind of incredible story. You know, could something like this really, could this really be happening? And the ideas and the themes that blurb kind of raised was really the jumping off point for Danielle in wanting to explore this man's story.
And to be clear, he wasn't, this is going to sound weird, he wasn't just a warlord. He was one of the most brutal, a legendary figure.
Well, he was a legendary figure, but actually in Liberia's civil war, there were a multitude of actors. And he was not considered one of the top architects of the war, not on the level of somebody like Charles Taylor. He was more of a mid-level general, and there were many of these kind of mid-level fighters. But what really sort of made him rise to prominence was this unusual style of fighting.
The fact that he fought naked.
Correct.
And his soldiers, child soldiers, did too?
Yeah, he recruited numerous child soldiers, and they all were sort of indoctrinated in this spiritual belief, and they would all run down the street naked. And, you know, many of the journalists that we spoke to who were there covering the war would talk about, you know, seeing this phenomenon and being completely dumbfounded by it. And local people would see these naked warriors running down the street, too. And it was actually a very effective tactic because when they saw the fighters nude, they believed that they were impervious to bullets, so they would run in the opposite direction. They were absolutely terrifying.
Dude, I want to talk about this whole question of redemption and the personal journey General Butt Naked has been on, but before we do that, we do, you know, painful as it is, kind of need to understand the scope of what he did. So he had an army of children he'd recruited. He also routinely killed children, sacrificed them.
Yes, General Butt Naked was, I mean, the Liberian Civil War was. It's an oversimplification, but essentially it was a fight for power, a fight for dominance in the nation over the course of roughly 14 years. And General Butt Naked was a member of a faction that, you know, many of the factions were divided along ethnic lines. He was a member of a group of people, an ethnic group in Liberia called the Kron group, the Kron people. And General Butt Naked was, as Danielle mentioned, he wasn't one of the leaders of that group or really an architect of the war, but he was a frontline general. And in so far as the scope of his activities, for about a year, he was active on the battlefield and was notorious for, you know, leading an army of naked child soldiers, many who were, you know, manipulated through, you know, narcotics and other means to commit all sorts of horrid atrocities in the defense of, you know, the Kron people, I guess you could say. Although that would be their explanation of what they were doing. And yes, I mean, it was routine for the fighters in Liberia to commit all sorts of murder, rape, and many of the groups, such as Butt Naked and his organization, had some very deep traditional spiritual beliefs, which often entailed human sacrifice and cannibalism as a means to not only terrorize their enemy, but obtain what they believed were spiritual protections or powers to move forward in the conflict.
And he's been pretty open about this, right? I mean, he's described part of his pre-battle ritual was sacrificing a child.
Absolutely. He has been very forthcoming, both when he is giving a sermon or talking about his past, as well as to journalists or filmmakers like ourselves, in terms of detailing what it was that they would do before certain battles. Absolutely. And in certain cases, that would involve things such as human sacrifice.
Bly, he actually claims that at 11 years of age, he was indoctrinated as a traditional priest of the Kron tribe, and that he was instructed in these ritual child sacrifice.
Does that mean he first killed someone when he was 11?
That's what he claims. And there's really no way for us to verify anything like this, because it's a deeply secretive aspect of Liberian society and somewhat obscure. So, if you believe his claims that he was indoctrinated at such an early age, you know, it's something that he argues, and other people who are supporters of Bly argue that he himself was, in essence, a sort of a type of child soldier. He sort of was indoctrinated into or sort of manipulated at a young age into committing these crimes as well.
Mm. And there was the sacrifice, and then there are rumors of cannibalism as well. Do you think those are true?
Again, you know, well, I mean, actually, I would say that let's just say that the issues of human sacrifice and cannibalism are sort of deep-seated in traditional belief systems in Liberia that were, according to numerous historians, experts, were probably quite bastardized during the conflict, because you had all of these child soldiers acting out what they believed were traditions, whether they were engaged in them, for whatever reasons they were engaged in them. And while, as Danielle said, it's very hard to really talk at any great depth on some of these issues, because they were happening secretly, there is footage of some of these sacrifices, some of the cannibalistic acts. I know of one bit of footage that is existent regarding that. So I don't think a lot of people disagree that these atrocities occurred during the war, and probably I think a lot of anthropologists would agree that they probably occurred in secret before the war. They're by no means widespread. These are not things that many Liberians would agree with or see as commonplace or normal, if you will, activities for one to engage in.
Mm-hmm.
They're just as atrocious to the vast majority of the Liberian public as they would be to outsiders.
Mm. So then, one day, he just changed. He had a religious conversion experience. He says he saw Jesus and he stopped. He put down his weapons. He walked away. He says he's a new man. I guess the main question your film is really asking is that possible?
Absolutely. And not only is it possible, but if, you know, somebody attempts to make a change like this, how does that play out in the real world? It's such a sea change. And it's really difficult to wrap your mind around any kind of claim of transformation that large. And as you watch the film, you know, as he engages in these everyday acts of you know, begging for forgiveness from his victims, you're constantly trying to sort of reconcile what he did in the past with what he's trying to be now, and it's incredibly, incredibly challenging.
So how did this happen, that a guy who was, in a sense, raised to be a warlord turned around, walked away, and now seems to be genuinely asking for forgiveness?
Well, what happened to General Butt Naked, and what really was the, you know, the stimulus for his transformation, really fell down to, you know, really came down to one man named Pastor John Kunkun, who was an evangelical preacher, minister at the time, and still is. He's a bishop today, during the mid-90s, in 1996. And he was a part of a group of evangelical preachers who were attempting to have an effect on the conflict, a positive effect, to end the conflict that was really ravaging their country at the time. I mean, this was at the height, 1996 was really at the height of much of the conflict in Liberia. And, you know, as Pastor Kuhn tells it, you know, these men decided to reach out to the warlords to try to speak to the warlords and tell them what they were doing was, you know, they weren't the heroes they saw themselves as, defending their ethnic group or their people, if you will. They were, you know, perpetrating atrocities across the nation and causing, you know, mass suffering. So these preachers, and they were very, you know, in many ways extremely courageous men, went out into, you know, walked off into the front lines, and Pastor Kuhn went to this area of Monrovia that was controlled by General Butt Naked and his fighters, and approached him, just walked right up and entered his headquarters and spoke boldly to General Butt Naked and told him, you know, that what he was doing was, you know, to use Pastor Kuhn's vocabulary, a sin and a crime, you know, in the eyes of God. And that really became, that moment between those two men became the beginning of the end for the persona of General Butt Naked. It was after that moment and a series of meetings that would continue to happen between these two men that led General Butt Naked to lay down his weapons and depart from the front line in late 1996 and become Joshua Milton Blahi, which is what he goes by today.
And, I mean, I suppose he could have just walked away, disappeared somewhere, made a new life under a completely new name. He didn't choose to do that.
Well, actually, you know, when he did walk away, there was a lot of pressure for him to rejoin the war. The war kind of died down soon after his conversion, and then it sort of ramped back up for a second phase. And during that second phase, there was a lot of pressure from members of the Kron tribe and other political figures that he was involved with for him to rejoin the fighting. So he went into exile. He got married. He started a family, and he tried to stay as far away from the fighting in Liberia as possible to avoid any temptation of kind of sliding back into his old persona. So he spent several years outside of Liberia. And our film really picks up when he decides to return. He was living in exile in the Budaburam refugee camp in Ghana, where a number of Liberian refugees still live today. And we sort of follow him from his journey from Budaburam back to Liberia, where he attempts to reconcile with a lot of his victims' families.
Why does he want to do this?
Why does he want to reconcile?
Yeah.
I mean, this is really, in many ways, a lot of hopefully what our film is challenging our audience to think about, to acknowledge. I don't think there's an easy answer for that. I mean, if you were to listen to Blahi say it, you know, he claims to have a full understanding of Christianity, of his new faith, and what he needs to do to truly become a Christian and to truly put down, you know, his persona of General But Naked. I think he acknowledges that he can never truly balance the scales of his past, but, you know, again, in his words, he believes that, you know, this is the only way to sort of, the only way to truly be a Christian is to continue on that journey, attempting to balance the scales of his past. And of course, what Danielle and I try to put forth in the film is if that is even possible, and number one, and also to really examine a man like Bly's motivations. And I think that becomes worth looking at when you see him engage with these, you know, his former victims, when you see him make his way across Liberia, when you see what happens to him when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission comes to Liberia. You know, we sort of judge him through his actions and present him through his actions, not just his words. And it becomes a much more complicated, hopefully much more complicated understanding of a man and his motivations.
Well, I mean, let's talk about this and some of those moments when he's trying to apologize. I mean, there's a moment in the film when he's talking to a woman and he says, "I'm sorry I killed your brother. I didn't mean to." Well, yes, he did mean to, don't you think? I mean, he killed people on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in moments like that, you get a sense of his real struggle with his, you know, his past actions. And I think in the film itself, in the beginning of the film, that moment where he's approached this woman and he's apologizing for the crimes that he committed in the past, he kind of, you can see that he's really struggling to find a way to interact with these people, and he can come across as very belligerent in some ways. You know, at one point he uses the language, "You have to forgive me."
Yeah, I mean, he's putting a lot of pressure on her to forgive him. And as a viewer, I mean, I sort of feel like that's not something he's entitled to ask for.
Sure. And it's absolutely very uncomfortable. But, you know, that encounter happened at the beginning of when we started filming. And over the years, as we continue to follow him, Eric and I noticed sort of a change as he became more comfortable with the role of approaching people and asking for forgiveness. There was a change in his demeanor, and he started to approach people differently and sort of he began to learn from some of his mistakes. And you'll notice that, you know, for example, in the reconciliation that happens between him and Lavetta and her family, or DeConso, he's much more subdued, and he sort of allows them to come to him, you know, at their own comfort level.
What was the most moving of those for you?
I mean, one moment that was perhaps the most moving for me, or one of the reconciliation moments, was when Bly approached Lovetta and her daughter. Because I think that initially you think of these reconciliation moments as about Bly, but as you really spend time and you witness them and you witness the hurt and the pain that has happened to these Liberians, I think in the end that those moments are truly about the victims. And Bly is not really what is important to us at those moments in many ways. It is the healing that is taking place, hopefully, for those victims, that ability to, you know, make peace with their past and confront it, you know, in the face of Bly and move beyond it and heal. And I think for me, when Lovetta's daughter was confronted with Bly, you know, you see her on camera crying. And I, at the time that Danielle and I were shooting, just assumed, you know, this poor girl, you know, she's terrified. You know, this man who murdered her, or this man's army murdered her father and caused, you know, wounded her for life. And she's crying, and I just assumed it was from fear. But later, she said that she was crying because, you know, it touched her to see someone who had hurt her come forward and beg for her forgiveness. And I mean, that my mind was as a non-Liberian, as a Westerner, my mind, the way I necessarily understand justice and forgiveness, I never would have went there in my mind. I don't think I would have sat there if I had been the wounded party and had a thought like that. And that touched me. I mean, this was a girl who was 14, 15 years old, and I thought that was an extremely profound way to approach, you know, reconciliation and healing.
So does it make a difference for the victims, a permanent difference, do you think, when Blahi comes up and when they can confront him and when he can say he's sorry?
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent, regardless of whether or not we believe Blahi, you notice that a lot of the victims that he approaches are sort of using the situation for their own means, for their own ability to heal and move beyond the past. I mean, they certainly don't expect a perfect man before them. But, you know, DeConso, who we continue to be in touch with, has expressed numerous times that just the ability to meet Blahi and to experience that moment of reconciliation was kind of like a weight lifted off of his shoulders. The ability to forgive for him was extremely beneficial on a psychological level, regardless of whether or not Blahi actually deserves it. And, you know, that's something that viewers will, you know, make their own judgments and reserve for themselves. But it is undeniable that the ability to bestow forgiveness on somebody can have really powerful effects for the person who's doing it.
Blahi does also has reached out and is doing a fair amount of work with some of the former child soldiers, you know, people he kidnapped or brought into his army, hooked on drugs, taught to fight. He says that he's the one who should do it. Do you agree?
I think this is a more, you know, this is one of those extremely complicated issues. Because as you see in the film, you know, Danielle and I were there witnessing Blahi reaching out to former fighters of all the different factions, attempting to act as a role model for them and show them that, you know, you can change, you can, you know, in Blahi's words, you know, he accepted Christianity and is you know, acting as a preacher, attempting to turn these young men's lives around, bring them out of, you know, the slums and the ghettos where they are involved in drugs and crime and to turn their lives around. And on the one hand, that's extremely admirable. And in many ways, Blahi is very well placed to do that since, you know, as many of the fighters have said to Danielle and I, and they say in the film, you know, as bad as they were, he was worse. So to see someone like that be able to pull himself out of a sense of guilt at what they've done and move on with their lives and reach out to people, he is a powerful symbol to those young men. Simultaneously, though, I think it's also very uncomfortable to witness Blahi sort of reassuming a position of power with these young men. You know, there is a scene in the Victory Church where he is encouraging and getting these men, all of these young men worked up about changing their lives, but it is somewhat, you know, frighteningly reminiscent of what he must have been like on the streets of Monrovia in 1996 as General Butt Naked, kind of working up these young men to do, you know, to commit atrocities. And I think that's where that uncomfortable moment lies. And it kind of brings us back again to re-examining Blahi's, you know, motivations. Is this a guy who put down one sort of, you know, means to power and has picked up another? I mean, what is really motivating him at these moments? Because it is a very uncomfortable place for a figure like him to be in again.
Yeah, because I mean, one of the uncomfortable things about watching this film is that Bly comes across as a likable guy. I mean, he's warm, he's funny, he's engaging. I mean, there must have been times he told a joke and you laughed, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's one of the things that drew us to the story in the first place. I mean, questions of, you know, people who commit atrocities are, you know, they're people, you know, they can be very charismatic and very effective at sort of winning you over. And I think for us, part of the challenge was really create, you know, sort of in the film, creating a portrait of a human being, as difficult and as uncomfortable as that may be for us to accept. I think in a lot of ways, if you're able to understand the humanity of a person who is able to commit so many atrocities, it really forces you to sit back and reflect on the nature of evil and who are the types of people who can commit evil. And it's really uncomfortable for us to accept that you know, these types of crimes can be committed by people who are you know, charismatic, likable, and seemingly just ordinary.
Well, or that's part of his brilliance, is making himself seem likable and quote-unquote ordinary. I mean, wasn't there part of you that thought, of course he's likable, he's a sociopath? I mean, that no matter what he says, he has no conscience.
You know, I mean, Eric and I definitely struggled with that throughout the making of the film. We definitely, you know, every day felt like we were on a roller coaster ride of evaluating his character. And at the end of the night, we would sort of debrief with each other and have some really intense conversations about how we were reacting to him and sort of perceiving his actions and how we felt about his character. And I think that, you know, it was constantly in flux for us, and we were really lucky to have each other to sort of bounce these ideas off of each other, because we, you know, often were not totally in agreement, or we'd experience something in completely different ways. And I think having two heads, two perspectives to sort of interpret what it was that we were experiencing being around him was enormously helpful.
Did you worry that there was a danger that you were being manipulated by him, sucked into his orbit?
Oh, I think that's absolutely something that we wrestled with and we worried about. I mean, 100%. I mean, and that goes back to what Danielle was saying about those late night conversations, those, you know, as you very rightly pointed out, Bly is a likable guy. I mean, people don't achieve leadership positions like his without being likable and charismatic. There is no doubt he is charismatic, and he can definitely suck you into his orbit. And whether, you know, and I don't really think it's always intentional or not, or that he's pulling anyone's strings, you know, overtly. It just has a lot to do with the way he is. And I think it really was incumbent upon Danielle and I to keep ourselves in check throughout this process, because, you know, we weren't there in the mid-90s. We didn't see the crimes perpetrated at the moment. We spoke to the victims, we spoke to the perpetrators, we spoke to the witnesses, but we didn't see them with our own eyes. And there's very little photographic or video evidence of, let's just say, but naked in his army's crimes. So that, you know, you really have to constantly remind yourself that this individual is one and the same person. You know, that sea change that Danielle mentioned earlier is enormous. But it really is, in the end of the day, the same person. And you have to constantly keep yourself aware of that, or you can kind of get lost.
Do you like him?
That's a good question. I mean, I think in some ways, I think that the question itself, you know, the reality of the situation is a little bit bigger than that. I mean, it's hard to sort of distill it down to, you know, whether or not you like somebody. I mean, he is a perpetrator of atrocities, and it's kind of hard to get around that on some level. But he can be a very likable person to be around. But every time you might begin to feel that way, your mind sort of automatically wanders back to what it is he did. And that always presents a certain level of discomfort.
I would also, you know, I completely agree with Danielle on that and say that on many levels, it's not really an issue of like. I mean, is he a likable guy? Yeah. Are there moments when we get on with him? Yeah. We spent 5 years documenting his journey. At the end of the day, though, you know, it gets to the issue of, is he genuine or not as well? I mean, is he likable? Sure. Does it matter? You know, I'm not sure it necessarily does. At the end of the day, he is guilty of these crimes. And that takes us to another step, which is, you know, is the issue of justice. You know, again, is he genuine or not? Is he sincere or not? Even if he is, that only takes you so far in the questions surrounding individuals like Blahi and other Liberian perpetrators.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the questions surely is there a line beyond which somebody can't be forgiven, can't, you know, be allowed to reinvent himself?
Yeah, I mean, Eric and I, we actually had worked together prior to this film. We had worked in television doing documentaries about life in prison. And we had been around numerous perpetrators of crimes. And, you know, we both had sort of developed this interest in the idea of, you know, moving beyond your past and redemption. And when we decided to take on Joshua Blahi's story, we were drawn to it for the precise reason that it kind of takes the idea of redemption to its greatest possible extreme. It really tests the limits of the very notion of change and somebody's ability to redeem themselves. And we didn't really know what we would find when we decided to explore these issues, but I think that, you know, when you watch the film, you know, every moment that he's on screen, every action that he takes, as a viewer, you're really sitting there not only evaluating Blahi, but the very notion of redemption is on, in a way, it's on trial itself.
That issue, redemption, is at the heart of this film. What does redemption mean to you?
Big question. I think that, let's just say in the case of Liberia and Liberians, for me, and Danielle, you might want to weigh in here as well. I think for me, in their case, in Liberia's case, redemption means healing, means moving forward. Because I think that's the only thing that's truly important right now in Liberia, and it is the biggest issue at stake, is how does this country, how do these people, how do all these millions of individual lives heal from these 14 years of horror? And I think that for me, that is what redemption here means. And I don't think it is an easy path, and I don't think that. You know, I think hopefully Danielle and my film gets people thinking about these issues, thinking about reconciliation and justice in a post-conflict nation. I don't believe that we've necessarily given up any answers so much as hopefully raised a number of the key questions. I also think that, you know, when thinking about redemption and reconciliation in a place like Liberia, you have to keep in mind that our feelings as Westerners, as Americans, with our, you know, legal apparatus, with our justice system, don't really apply to a situation like that, because there is no justice there. There is no accountability right now in Liberia. You know, there is no war crimes tribunal. So all of these perpetrators are walking the streets of the country as free as any of the victims and all of the other civilians. And I think that has to be taken into account when we look at the situation there and when we think about what reconciliation and redemption means for a place like that.
I would also add that, you know, I think that I've come to understand throughout the process of making of this film the idea of redemption as a process. It's not an absolute place or a state of being. And a number of, you know, Bishop John Kunkun, who we spoke to in the film, actually kind of makes this point that it is a journey. It's not a place that you can arrive at. And that's very much how I see Joshua Bly, his attempts at reconciliation. You know, the redemption of General Butt Naked is not a fact. It's more a process, a sort of a state of attempting to, you know, right the wrongs of his past. And I don't think that, you know, in my mind, I don't feel that it's so much that he's achieved redemption, but he's attempting to. And it really remains to be seen through his actions. You know, will he continue to stay on the path that he's chosen and continue to sort of develop, or will he sort of fall back into kind of, you know, a more selfish motive?
Well, you call the film The Redemption of General Butt Naked, but in talking about it, it's pretty clear that what the film is really about for you is about the redemption of Liberia, that it's about the victims, not about General Butt Naked or Joshua Bly's, you know, the personal state of his soul. And at the same time, so then I guess the issue is, what's best for Liberia? What's best for his former victims? What's best for the child soldiers, the former child soldiers? Is it better for them to have him walking around, interacting with them, apologizing? Or would it be better for them if he disappeared or if he was put in prison, called to justice for his crimes?
This is a massive, you know, an extraordinarily big issue in Liberia, what to do with regards to the crimes of the past, 14 years, and all of these perpetrators. And I think it's a very complex question. I mean, there is no world in which all of these perpetrators are ever going to be tried and justice is going to be served. That's not realistic, and that, you know, just as in Germany during World War II or after World War II, that's not going to happen. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission did try to bring about a measure of healing and reconciliation through having perpetrators and victims come forward and attempt to get a feeling of you know, sort of national reconciliation through truth-telling, through, you know, talking about the atrocities that happened and what happened and why, so that the nation would never repeat the same mistakes. You know, and Danielle, maybe you want to step in at a certain point as well. I mean, I think for myself, I think accountability is a part of healing and reconciliation. And I think that there needs to be some degree of accountability that happens in Liberia to ensure that these types of crimes don't happen again. Whether that necessarily involves a player like General Butt Naked being prosecuted, that would remain, you know, up to the Liberians, as he was not necessarily truly an architect of the war. But I think for reconciliation, for true reconciliation and healing to happen, eventually there will need to be some degree of accountability there. That, at least that's my personal feelings. Danielle?
I mean, I think that, you know, nobody would argue with the fact that Liberians have been shortchanged on justice. It's something that, you know, many people in the country would like to see. But the difficulty is that the country is still very fragile. It's still, there's very much a sense of instability at times. And there's a worry that if justice were to be called for, if there was a war crimes court in the country, that the you know, the agents of the war would protest with violence and the country would descend back into a vortex of chaos, just like in the 90s when the war was at its worst. And, you know, in fact, there were, when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was happening, a number of the former warlords banded together and said, we're not going to participate in this process because we believe that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is actually gathering evidence to prosecute us in a war crimes tribunal if it ever does come to pass. So many people were very resistant. Prince Johnson, who is actually a current senator in Liberia, he was very resistant initially to the TRC process. And Blaye was the first warlord to sort of break that impasse and break ranks with the other warlords who were refusing to participate in the process and say, I do believe that this is valuable and worthy, and I'm going to be the first major perpetrator to go forward. You know, what his motivations were in that process, you know, you can certainly question. But the TRC process itself was incredibly difficult. There was, you know, there were threats made against the TRC commissioners. I mean, it sort of reinforced for Liberians the fragility of the peace that they had achieved. So I think that discussions of a war crimes tribunal are still ongoing. And, you know, hopefully one day Liberians will be able to achieve some measure of accountability and justice. But for now, a lot of people have felt that the TRC process of truth-telling and reconciliation is the best first step for them.
Going back to the question of going back to Joshua Blaye and his own personal journey, there's this question that I kept having as I watched the film, and it has to do with the genuineness, or it's not even quite the right word. It had to do with whether he's really able to take in what he did. I mean, of course he understands it. I guess there's part of me that thinks if you really, really fully took in the depth of suffering you'd caused, how could you keep living?
This is something that Danielle and I have talked about, you know, as you can imagine, many times over the years that we were out there shooting. And it is a very difficult question, because I think we would both agree with you, certainly at various times during this 5-year journey, that, I mean, how could you even accept this degree of guilt? And I think there's lots of different ways of looking at this. I mean, on the one hand, you see Blaye, and, you know, in a way, to be cynical about it, he kind of traded one belief system, a traditional belief system that allowed him to perpetrate these crimes and feel that he was righteous while doing them, and traded it in for another belief system that now tells him all of that was wrong and he needs to make amends. And is he, as an individual, fully understanding the repercussions and fully, you know, digesting what he did and how wrong it was and why it's truly important to reach out to these people? You know, that's a question that's still a difficult question to answer. You know, on the flip side, maybe on a less cynical, you know, in a less cynical approach, you know, as Danielle stated earlier, you know, there is no justice right now, and this nation has been shortchanged, and it is due to the fragility of the peace there. And given that context, one has to ask oneself, why does Blaye put himself out there then? There is no justice coming for him. He doesn't have to pay in any way. He could just go about his life. He doesn't need to put himself in these uncomfortable situations confronting individuals like Lovetta and her daughter, or DeConso. He doesn't need to, you know, put himself at frankly great risk to himself in front of the TRC and open up, you know, to all of their questions about the atrocities he perpetrated during the war. So that, you know, on some level makes you stop and say, okay, so why does he do it? There's no power or financial gain that he's necessarily getting out of this. So really, what motivates this man? And I guess for us, it has really truly been a bit of an emotional roller coaster attempting to understand him. And I think there's still a lot of questions that confront us even to this day after all these years of witnessing him.
I mean, were there moments where you felt like, yeah, right there, right then, he felt it. He was overcome with what he had done.
Well, there is a moment in the film when he's confronted with the death of Senegalese. Senegalese was one of his former fighters, and he was responsible for shooting Senegalese in the legs, and Senegalese lost his legs and was confined for the rest of his life to a wheelchair. And while Blaye was in exile in Ghana, Senegalese passed away of tuberculosis, and he's, you know, sort of blaming himself, you know, in a roundabout way for Senegalese's death. You know, what could I have done to stop it? And, you know, he does seem to be, you know, there's a moment when he just closes his eyes and you see this very pained expression on his face. You know, there are no words to sort of try to describe what could possibly be going through his mind. And then he gets up and he goes into the bathroom and you can sort of hear him begin to cry a little bit, you know, and he says, like, when is this all going to end? And for me, I did feel in that moment that was as close as we were going to get to a kind of emotional revelation from him. Because I think to some extent there is a little bit of dissociation that must take place in the mind of somebody who's committed these types of crimes. I don't really know how he can contain that level of guilt for so many atrocities. I really just don't know how a single individual could contain that. But the human mind is a really mysterious and sometimes frightening place. So we're just, you know, left to ponder, you know, is he a sociopath? I mean, does he not truly feel the way that his actions do affect other people? And if he does feel it, you know, how in the world can he live with it?
Thank you. Thank you. That was great. Yeah, with a film like this, it's hard to... It leaves you with all these questions. So thanks for talking.
Thank you.
Sure, thanks.